Welcome to the bookshelf. We continue with African Rice Heart, written and read by Emily Wilkins.
Naivety lets me go. Before I left home, there was a send-off meal for the children and the families of whom my brothers and I grew up with. Many were going to boarding schools or colleges, some of them in faraway countries. After the meal was over, each of the parents spoke a few words of wisdom and release. My dad said a few things, but one of the things that really stuck out in my head was this. In our youth and naivety, we don't know how hard certain things are, and that's why we try them. That's what allows us to do things that people with more experience might not even attempt. Once, back in high school, I got carried along by the hype of a moment, and I ate a big live beetle. Everyone in the class was yelling, "Do it, do it, do it," and offering money left and right, and when the bribe reached $45, I chomped down on that bug while the wings were still flapping. The taste was one of the bitterest I've ever known. I look back on that and I wonder, what were you thinking, Emily? I think maybe for the right price I would do it again, though now the price would have to be huge. But it really wasn't so much the money as it was my naivety and the challenge of the first time that pushed me to do it that day. Last summer, I was at Priest Lake with my family. Alex, Laura, who's my younger brother's girlfriend, and Nilmany, Taylor's fiancé, were there too. Late one day, Alex and I were sitting on the beach and we noticed this one mountain across the lake, and one of us said, "We should climb that. That's not that tall." And without any arguments or hesitations, we jumped in a canoe, paddled across the lake, and started trekking up the mountain. No trail, no compass, just the goal of getting to the top. The top of that mountain was a lot farther away than we had expected. On the hike, we got dirty, sweaty, scraped up, but when we summited, we felt so invincible. It was like the naivety that my dad was talking about. It was the way that kids go for things without even knowing what to expect, or perhaps expecting only the best. Yesterday, the four other volunteers and I took a trip. We more or less planned it by tossing around a few ideas. We decided that we'd borrow bikes from our African friends and then ride them to a village called Lai, about 18 kilometers away on the sandy roads. We started out around 8:30 a.m. carrying water, harmonicas, and bananas with us, all the essentials. The sand just grabs your tire and sucks it down, making the riding difficult. We hadn't gone more than 2 kilometers when we had our first bike accident, a minor one. Soon, bike wrecks were happening frequently, but they couldn't dampen the elation that we were feeling. The music from our harmonicas almost gave a fairy tale feeling that day, a feeling I hadn't felt in so long. We reached Lai in just over 2.5 hours. We probably could have made the trip in much shorter time, but you have to understand that our bikes are ancient. One of my tires was doing some kind of tilting orbital rotation around the axle, and I thought it would fall off at any moment. Ansley literally has bruises on her butt from sitting on a metal seat that had no padding, and Kristen could hardly control the direction that her bike took in the sand. The road ended at a wide, brown, slow-moving river with Lai in sight on the other side. When we started the trip, we didn't know that the bridge was under construction, still with about 100 yards left undone. Shirtless men in dugout canoes offered to take us and our bikes across the river for about 50 cents. As we piled in, we noticed that they had stitched the cracks in their dugout with thick rope. Don't ask me how you so would. I spent a lot of the boat ride trying to figure that out myself. Setting long poles against the river's bottom, the boatmen pushed the boat along at a diagonal angle upstream and across the river, and the water baler had a full-time job essential to getting us across to the other side. In Lai, we sat down in this shabby makeshift restaurant. I still don't know what I ate. It was so rubbery that I felt like my teeth were on a trampoline. It came in a thin sauce that was glimmering with oil, and it was accompanied by 2 breadsticks speckled with flower mites. Back at the river, we changed into our swimming suits behind the bushes. At the edge of the cliff, we found a place where we could make a running leap into the mucky, muddy water. Probably not the cleanest thing I've ever done, but definitely not the most boring thing either. The ride home was glorious. The sun set right in the dirt path in front of us. 24 miles on rickety bikes. Thanks, naivety.
African Rice Heart, Part 7, To Choose or Not to Choose.
Have you ever heard people say that our lives are made up of all the choices we've made? That we're the drivers of our own cars and that we choose when we'll turn the steering wheel, pump the brakes, put the pedal to the metal? I've always kind of thought that way, but what about those people whose mothers never took them where they could learn to drive a stick shift car on a steep hill? And then they're given a junky car and told that they have to drive blindfolded through hilly downtown Seattle at rush hour. Some people draw short sticks. They're dealt bad hands. We don't get to choose what comes to us. I'm not usually some patriotic flag waver, but I sure do recognize that as an American, the balance has tipped in my favor. I'm so thankful I wasn't born in Chad. There, I said it. Seems like I shouldn't be saying it. Seems like this unspoken truth that, when I speak it, reveals me as someone who has realized her luck and doesn't want to give it up. But Africa is teaching me that freedom isn't found in our ability to choose every turn and rest stop on our highway. God knows we've all had to take detours because the roads that we chose were covered with obstacles that we couldn't get over. We've had to deal with things that we never chose, never asked for. Maybe our freedom lies in our ability to keep moving no matter what happens to us. So many people in Chad are doing just that. They don't have much, but they're using what they have to move in some direction they've chosen. Directions like being kind, being honest, and getting an education. This is a party. The other night, I went to a party. A Chadian-style party. When I think of parties, I think of a certain atmosphere. You know, a celebration where the host and guests bring good things to share and then they all try to connect with each other. I was really curious about whether partiers here would create the same atmosphere. Actually, whether they would even be able to have a party because I didn't know where we were all going to sit. I mean, chairs are such a luxury here, and what were we going to eat? I mean, mostly they just eat rice. And then what were we going to talk about? Language is such a barrier. And whether there would be music, maybe static radio? I just couldn't imagine a party in Chad. People started arriving, and I could tell that everyone was hungry. We had been told that we didn't have to eat beforehand, that there would be a lot of food. I saw little tables all set up with mismatched china. They served savory crepes and offered the choice of two different sauces, one of them vegetarian, which meant non-goat. The second course was juice, and the third course was rice bowl with more sauce. And by that time, we were full. The vegetarian sauce was leafy green, which I knew wasn't a good party food because everyone who ate it would have green particles all over in their teeth. I was right. I could tell that people were still a little bit self-conscious when they talked, and everyone was running their tongues over their teeth. But then, the host gave us each a toothpick. They have thought of everything. We left the party full and went to sundown worship over at the church. It was the beginning of the Sabbath, that day intended to give us rest from the work in the past week and a celebration of God's presence with us. After worship, we agreed that the party wasn't over yet and that we'd all go back to the hut for a bonfire, which is rare here in Chad because wood is so scarce, and then we'd go back for singing and for a fourth course of food. The fire was going when we arrived, and our worship continued in singing, accompanied by guitar and African drums. During the moments of silence that interspersed the singing, we felt a contentment that was also a form of praise. So the Chadian party certainly was celebratory. I couldn't believe how they used everything they had to move us all towards celebration. The extravagance was in their generosity, not in what they'd put on the dinner table. It reminded me so much of the woman who had so little but gave it all. And Jesus said that's what brought so much meaning to her giving. What a party when people give you their best. You just feel it. Oh, little girl. Josephine wailed all night again. Her foot certainly must hurt her. After all, it's infected down to the bone. But the instability of her mind is just amplifying her pain and causing her so much distress and lack of peace. She has a little vial of ketamine, which we give to her when we're changing the dressing, and then another ampule of diazepam for the nights when she screams, keeping everyone in the hospital awake. But last night, the ampule was empty. It was 1 a.m., and the night already seemed so long because of the urinary surgery patient, whose catheter kept getting blocked with clots, and the irrigating flow of water had to be watched, or his bladder would swell and he would have awful pain. I peeked around the corner to make sure that Josephine wasn't trying to climb out of bed in an attempt to go home, something she's done numerous times. What I saw was so unfair. What I saw was strength and weakness in a child all at once. In the midst of all her crying, Josephine called for her 7-year-old granddaughter, who was sleeping on the cement floor, until she finally got up. The child was exhausted, and Josephine said something in Nandre that obviously meant, "Come up on the bed with me." The little girl followed the orders, climbed up on the bed, and sat behind her grandmother. Then Josephine took the little girl's arm and wrapped them around herself while she continued crying. The little girl didn't know what to do for her grandmother, who was rocking back and forth and wailing. The girl's eyes were wide, and I could tell that she was just plain scared. Pulling Josephine's grip off the little girl, I set her little bare feet back down on the cement and said, "You can sleep." The sweet child quietly lay back down while Josephine latched onto my hand and cried some more. I wanted to scold Josephine for waking up her granddaughter and scaring her, but I know that mental disease is often no one's fault. It makes me want to cry. I saw the strength of this little girl when I came to help her off the bed. She had these tears in her eyes, but none of them were falling. She was so strong for her grandma. Her weakness lay in the fact that she couldn't choose to be in any other situation. Every day she helps prepare food for her grandma. She looks after her baby sister, and she brings her grandmother the water that she needs to take her meds. I wish Josephine's leg would just get better so this girl can leave the hospital. It's no place for her. The man in the red underwear. I went to the river again this afternoon. Just needed a break by myself. But today I wasn't by myself. There was this little old man there with a long branch of a tree, and he was using it as a fishing pole. When he finished fishing, he stripped down to some very old underwear. And then he sat there on the bottom of the river, his ribbed torso sticking up out of the surface of the water, and he splashed himself. I began swimming against the current, letting it push against me, feeling good about this attempt at exercise. I breathed on my right side every other stroke, and I kept my eyes closed. But then I had this uneasy feeling. I stood up in the water and looked over where my horse was tied up, or where he had been tied up. Gone! Looking all around, I caught sight of her cantering off into the brush. In my very American swimsuit, which no African would ever wear, they don't wear things like that, I ran up the bank after the horse. When I finally caught her, I walked back to the river, back to the man in the red underwear. He told me I had good luck, but that I should bien attaché le cheval next time. I was embarrassed, but then I remembered that when you're embarrassed, imagining the people around you in their underwear is supposed to make you feel better. And I didn't even have to use my imagination. Bed springs. Esther was lying on our old set of bed springs, which sits on the bare steel frame. We've jammed a collage of retired shirts, pants, and other material between the springs to act as padding. I told Esther to make room for me, and she moved over until she took only half the bed. Then she asked me if I was going to sleep outside. I said, "Yeah, right here with you." So she got a blanket and we tucked ourselves in. Our bodies were close because the bed is so stubbornly narrow. Sleeping with Esther reminds me of sleeping with my cousins, Mindy and Lisa. They're missionary kids who would come to our home and live with us while they were on furlough from Africa. Lisa's a heater and a sprawler. Despite the unspoken three-way divisions of bed, Lisa's body has always taken whatever space it wanted to. Draped across me, pushing against Mindy, her legs sliding into my space, moving and fidgeting as they wished. In the middle of the night, I woke up with Esther's head on my shoulder, her arm linked through mine, one leg flopped over my trapped body, and she was breathing right in my eyes. I felt like we were blood sisters. When I awoke the next morning, Esther was already sweeping the courtyard. I sat up with groggy eyes and said a long, sleepy, "Lapia." As I stood up, Esther laughed at the way the metal bed springs had imprinted patterns on my legs and shoulders, and we decided that we needed to add more scrap clothes to the padding on the springs. Poor. I pulled on my Nike runners and changed into my university service day t-shirt and the tasseled Indian pants, which I sewed myself. The tassels swing around my ankles and they tickle me as I walk. Then I waited till Isidore got up. He doesn't have an alarm clock, so I can't blame him for being a few minutes late. He's sleepy-eyed and rubs his hands together and moves extremely slowly when he wakes up. Our neighbor Tabga, who is 18 and likes to ask me about the truths of America, came too. We were doing a 5 a.m. run. We started out, but just after a few strides, Isidore suddenly stopped. I turned around, intending to tell him to pick it up, and then I realized what he needed to do. And I laughed and I said that I would keep running while he took care of business right there on the side of the road. He caught up with us in a minute or two, and we wound through the village and out into the country. I was surprised at how many people we passed at that hour, heading to the rice fields with sharp blades and water containers balanced on their heads as they walked. As we passed them and greeted them with nods, they turned around slowly, keeping their buckets steady, but totally intrigued by the speed with which we moved at that hour in the morning. The sun began to rise. It was a jaw-dropping sunrise. I thought, maybe this is magic, the magic of God. It was a miracle of beauty. Seriously, my heart jumped at least 4 times. I can't stop talking about something that pretty. The sun cast itself up under the clouds and threw shots of different colors all about. All this light came from one big round ball of fire that was rising quicker than it does anywhere else I've been. I couldn't help but run backwards so I could watch it come. Our pace was perfect, and our breathing was so synchronized. We ran a solid 5K and returned home to shower out of our buckets and eat something mushy and warm. I don't see poverty so much anymore. I used to see it all the time. The dirty-handed little kids, awful old rusted bikes, clothing tinted brown from dirt, noses dripping with snot, no one wearing shoes, kids playing with bottle caps and dirty plastic bags and eating plain dirt-covered potatoes, pants so outgrown that the wearers can't zip them anymore, dirt houses. No poverty. But now, I've lived in a dirt house. I've played with bottle caps, I've gone barefoot, I've found my clothes wearing thin with holes in random places, and the kinds of poverty that I used to think needed to be solved right away aren't what I now consider the most pressing hardships of this place. I see the deeper poverty in the sadness of the mother who lost her 15-year-old to a fast-moving case of meningitis. And I see it in Polly's mother, who lay in the bed with him while he bled internally for so long and then died about a week ago. It's the poverty of the malnourished children. These kinds of suffering make me angry and frustrated. Having less isn't such a bad thing, but losing hope, as many people who suffer do, that's so hard for me to watch. But the most difficult thing for me to realize and to admit is that we have even bigger losses of hope back in the States. We didn't know that the bridge was under construction, still with about 100 yards left undone. Shirtless men in dugout canoes offered to take us and our bikes across the river for about 50 cents. As we piled in, we noticed that they had stitched the cracks in their dugout with thick rope. Don't ask me how you sew wood. I spent a lot of the boat ride trying to figure that out myself. Setting long poles against the river's bottom, the boatmen pushed the boat along at a diagonal angle upstream and across the river, and the water baler had a full-time job essential to getting us across to the other side. In Lye, we sat down in this shabby makeshift restaurant. I still don't know what I ate. It was so rubbery that I felt like my teeth were on a trampoline. It came in a thin sauce that was glimmering with oil, and it was accompanied by 2 breadsticks speckled with flower mites. Back at the river, we changed into our swimming suits behind the bushes. At the edge of the cliff, we found a place where we could make a running leap into the mucky, muddy water. Probably not the cleanest thing I've ever done, but definitely not the most boring thing either. The ride home was glorious. The sun set right in the dirt path in front of us. 24 miles on rickety bikes. Thanks, naivety. Kusimiya just seems to shake it all off. He's learned so much basketball. He runs. He's learning English really well. He just flies. But Kusimiya wanted shoes. He'd been running without them, but I could tell that he wanted them. And he'd frequently ask if his size had come in. This morning, when I saw that pair of Velcro shoes, I thought, this is the reason the Velcro shoes came. Taking them in hand, I asked the other kids where Kusimiya lived. They directed me there, and I found his family standing around with their big bowl, ready to take him out to the fields. I stood at a distance, because if this beast simply nodded his head in the wrong direction, he could put a hole in me with his horns. The littlest boy held the threat on a rope, and I asked him if he wasn't even a little bit scared. He said, "No," and hugged the massive animal from under his belly. "This kid is fearless." I told Kusimiya that I had some shoes for him, and his crooked smile just shot forth. I strapped the shoes on him, and they fit perfectly. He loved them. Lace-up shoes just wouldn't have worked for him because he can't tie with only one hand. I said, "You want to go now?" "Yes." So we went. Kumakung, the fearless 6-year-old, came with us. He had incredible endurance, and he didn't even stop once. I couldn't believe it. It was such a good birthday run. I hadn't seen the value in those Velcro shoes. It seemed like I've got this in my head that we have to have the best. But today on my birthday, I found that something was better than the best. And I'm so thankful for those of you who sent shoes, especially the Velcro pair. I'll never think of Velcro badly again, I promise. The right thing might be wrong. A young Arab girl lies limp across her father's arms. Her colorful necklace mimics her body and falls limp around her neck and shoulders. Her hemoglobin has fallen to a level of 2, very low. She needs blood. They check her blood type. She's A positive. Then each of her family members is also checked. The policy here is that we check the family first. If they have matching blood, then it's their responsibility to give it for their daughter. When none of the family members are matching donors, then volunteers and hospital staff can give blood. In this case, the girl's father was a perfect match. They told him that he should go to the lab right away and give blood so that she wouldn't die. At first, he didn't respond. Then he said something in Arabic. A local translated his words. "I don't want to give," is what he had said. What? At first, I thought maybe I had heard wrong or that he had misunderstood the gravity of the situation. The severity of the girl's condition was explained again. And again, his answer was, no, he wouldn't give. He didn't want to give his blood for his daughter. He was pressed for the reason. Was it fear? Some religious belief? He gave no reason. It made me so angry. I don't even know Arabic, but I couldn't help myself. I marched over to where he was sitting next to his curled up daughter and gave him a piece of my mind in a mix of English and French. It's amazing what hand signals and facial expressions can do. He just sat there and stared off into the distance. So I guess they don't do that much, but the family was sent away, told that if they weren't willing to fight for their daughter's health, that the hospital couldn't do anything. I went to Augustin, who had sent the family away, and I said, "Augustin, I'm A positive too, let me give." He said, "No, this is the family's responsibility. If people learn that they can be irresponsible and someone else will pick up the responsibility for their child, everyone will do this." I really respect Augustin. But at the same time, I couldn't justify this little girl dying a preventable death to teach a lesson. It wasn't her fault that her father wouldn't give blood. That was a really unsettling night. There has to be a better system. That's easy to say, but I have no idea what would work better. Systems, systems, systems. I know they're necessary, but I'm not a fan of the ones I've seen lately. What if something that's the wrong thing to do in one situation is the right thing to do in another? I so wonder if we don't underestimate God's unpredictability. He did bring his son into the world through an unwed mother, and his son ate with the tax collectors, and when the system required a stoning for the adulteress, he offered forgiveness. I'm having such a hard time knowing what the right thing is. Is the system wrong sometimes? Is the right thing wrong sometimes? Ugh. Tandem biking. 3 weeks left. It's not every day that I'm in Africa. Yeah, right now it seems to me that I am in Africa every day since I've been here for over 5 months, but despite that feeling, the truth is that today in Africa is a very exceptional day compared to the rest of my life. So I've been trying to make as many memories as I can, experience as many things, and learn as many lessons as I can in this last stretch. There's a motto that I've tried to adopt. It goes, "If you've been given a moment and you can either let it pass or go make a memory, always make the memory." So the other day, I took my camera and went for a long walk in search of things to photograph. I knew my mom would have a fit if she knew how few pictures I've actually taken at this point. As I walked out of town and toward the river, a wrinkly, elderly man came riding up beside me on one of those rickety bikes that I've written about. "Lapia, lapia, 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 budja!" "Okay, little guy, calm down," I thought. He stopped his bike to talk, and when he found out that we were going in the same direction, he told me that I could ride on the back of his bike. Wow, like hitchhiking. I would never in my life pass up a chance like that. So I sat on the little metal rack behind his bike seat and swung my legs down in case the takeoff wasn't as smooth as we wished. He tried to get going, but I was definitely bigger than he was. His frail little leg muscles couldn't push us down the sandy path on that dying bicycle. So we decided that I would give it a go and that he would ride in the back. That worked a lot better. The bike got tipsy in a few places, and there were times when I thought for sure we were going to take a tumble. However, we pulled it off. I even managed to take a snapshot of the two of us while riding the bike. We rode a few miles. This was no short jaunt, and I asked him a couple times, "Should we turn here? Should we stop here?" He always hurriedly shrieked his answer, "No, not yet. I'll tell you. I'll give you a warning before the road comes." I think he was worried that if we stopped, we wouldn't get going again. Eventually, we got to the next village, and the little man introduced me to his family and one of his wives, and then they started making plans to feed me. I knew it was getting dark, and I still had to run back the 3 miles. The sun had already set when I finally started jogging. It got darker and darker, and I started passing some interesting types of people. One straggly-looking man was walking in snake patterns, and his eyes hardly focused. Rice wine had gotten him good. I picked up my pace and sent cautious glances over my shoulder from time to time. Soon, a young boy came up beside me on his bike and started talking to me with all the English he knew. "Hello, how are you? I am fine. Where are you going? What is your name?" he said in one long stream. He sure knew how to get the conversation going. He accompanied me all the way home, not that I'm afraid of the dark or anything.
You've been listening to African Rice Heart, a young woman's journal of radical service. It was written and read by Emily Wilkins and published by Pacific Press Publishing Association, copyright 2011. Join us again next time as it continues. I'm Caitlin Webster. Ellie Hockett and I, from the Lewis and Clark PICI class, are the editors for these bookshelf programs, and Vern Windham is the producer.